Eric Weisberg on the telephone. How you doing, Eric?
I'm okay. How are you? How's everybody?
Everybody's great, man. The people are in the chat room waiting to hear from Eric Weisberg, and I am too. I'm so happy you were able to call in, and hopefully the motorcycle is not running, and we're not on the highway as you're calling.
That's true. No, that's not happening.
The I have in front of me, and there's a jumping off point, but we're going to go backwards from this. But I'm looking at I looked around. I don't have the New Dimensions in banjo and bluegrass, but everybody out there, we're going to fill in a lot of information about Eric Weisberg today. But everybody out there would probably recognize the theme, the soundtrack from the movie Deliverance. And as I told him when we opened the show, that that was really the re-release of an album that you had done with Marshall Brickman years earlier called New Dimensions in Banjo and Bluegrass. And then it was re-released with the Dueling Banjos recorded with you and Steve Mandel and on Warner Brothers. The original was on Elektra. But just so everybody knows, again, we dispel the myth that the kid on the bridge was not actually playing the banjo.
The kid sitting on the porch is not playing the banjo. he was on the bridge, too.
He was on the bridge and the porch.
He's not playing the banjo. As a matter of fact, I spent several hours working with him and getting him to look like he was sort of putting his fingers, in the general vicinity of the right place on the neck.
And I've had many teachers say the same thing about me, by the way.
it came out fairly good. I mean, when I saw it for the first time in the theater, by the way, they never told me when it was opening, and I saw it in the paper. I had to go pay my way in, me and my girlfriend, which was a little bit bizarre. It was kind of nice to see my name up there on the screen, doing the music and stuff, and it sounded good. I had no idea what I shouldn't say no idea what the movie was about. I knew it was about guys canoeing down a river and all that, but I really had no idea what really happened because we did the soundtrack in the studio in Atlanta. With the editor, and he was telling us what the scenes were, each scene, and he played two or three or 4 seconds or a minute or 18 seconds or whatever, with a sort of description of what was going on, and it was sort of vague. And then after that was over, and went back to New York, and it was like almost a year and a half till the movie came out. I had completely forgotten about the whole thing. And I was doing a session in the studio, I think probably a commercial or jingle. And in the break, one of the singers said to me, "Hey, Eric, I'm hearing your record on the radio." And I said, "What are you talking about? I don't have a record." And he said, "Well, I'm hearing it on the radio." I said, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about." And, he said, "Well, go downstairs to Times Square area where the studio was. There's a big record shop called Colony Records." And I knew one of the guys working there. And I go down there. I said, "Run downstairs, go in there." And I say, "Hey, George, you know something about a banjo record or something?" He says, "Yeah, I know about it." He says, "Is that you?" He goes, I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know what it is." He said, "Well, I'll get some. I'll bring them out. We'll play it." And, of course, it was us. It was me and Steve. That was the beginning of a long legal process that, wound up in court and was settled in court, settled out of court, actually. Trying experience when I didn't feel like I had anything to do with it and from what they did. And so, and then I just kind of watched it. I got a lawyer right away, by the way.
Good thinking.
And he's still my lawyer, and I was his first client out of law school. And now he's a big-time lawyer. So, that was good for both of us. And it got sorted out to where it's acceptable, and
Well,
to me, it's just one of the strangest, if not the strangest, story in the history of recorded music.
Well, okay. Now that you've now that you've teased that part of it, because we knew the Elektra release, and then we knew of the Deliverance soundtrack. But now that you've teased it like that, you're going to have to go in more detail if you're at liberty to speak about it.
Yeah, I can say.
Go ahead. Go. Yeah, go.
Well, I mean, you know, two guys playing in a gas station, how does this possibly become the number one hit on a banjo and a guitar, two instruments, you know, is really weird. But, you know, it is, I mean, what happened was I got a call, sitting at home, and I got a call, and the guy said, gave me his name, I can't think of it at the moment. Strange name, Rospo Pallenberg. He said, my name's Rospo Pallenberg, and I'm working with doing some things for this movie that's coming out. And he said, I was requested by Joe Boyd at Warner Brothers to give you a call and see if you knew, if you'd be interested in playing a scene for a movie, music for a scene in a movie. And I said, yeah, I'd be interested. It's kind of what I do, you know, He said, well, do you know a tune called Dueling Banjos? And I said, well, I know what you're talking about. That's not really the name of it. And he said, well, would you mind coming up to my apartment on the west side and just running it by me, playing it for me, and we can, he said, by the way, we want to do it with a guitar and a banjo. And I said, well, do you want to get the guitar player? And he said, no, you get somebody that you like. So I called my friend Steve, and we go up to this guy's apartment, and we start playing the tune down. And, you know, and he's saying, well, can you play it softer? Can you play it slower? Can you play it in a minor key? This and that, whatever. And so we managed to do all that stuff. And he said, okay, fine, we'll be in touch with you. And they called and said, okay, you got the job. And they flew us down to Atlanta. We got picked up and went from the airport to location, Clayton, Georgia, and met with John Borman. And by the way, John came up with, he was he who discovered the piece, and that it would be, he'd been looking for a long time for the right piece of music for that scene where these two guys have never seen each other before, and they start playing together, and they're answering each other.
It was perfect.
And I think what happened was, at least this is what I remember somebody telling me, that he and some of the people from the movie went out one night, and they went to see the Dillards, and the Dillards were playing, they played this tune that they were calling Dueling Banjo. And John said, oh, that's the perfect thing. You know, you've got to find somebody to play this for you, this and that. So that's eventually it got to me. Oh, what happened was they called Joe Boyd at Warner Brothers, and Joe called. His first call was Bill Keith, because they knew each other from the old days in Cambridge and Club 47 and all that stuff. So he called Bill to do the thing, and Bill was lucky for me, in a way, I suppose. Bill was on tour with somebody in Karen Dalton. He was on tour with Karen Dalton in either France or Spain or something, but somewhere in Europe. They were on a 3-month tour or something like that, and he said to Joe, he said, well, I can't break my contract. I'm contracted to play for all these concerts. It'd be about a month or, you know, 6 weeks or whatever it was. He said, well, why don't you call Eric? And, you know, so Joe called me. And, you know, I agreed to do it. And that's how it all came about. So we really didn't have any idea what it was about.
Well, let me ask you this. Why did they have to fly you to Georgia to record this?
Because he wanted to be sure that he knew how many answers they were going to be, how many, you know, call and responses there were going to be in this scene. He wanted to make sure of all the details and how they were going to set up Ronnie Cox with his guitar. Ronnie does play the guitar.
Yeah, but
he did. Want to play this. And he's a decent guitar player, but he just didn't want to do this. And so all those details, he wanted to be there to discuss it with us and give his ideas on how many, intercuts and back and forth and all okay. that stuff. So that's why we went down there.
So did you watch the filming of that scene of the kid on the porch at the gas station? And I don't know anything about the movie business, obviously, but you went down, you must have seen the scene so you could know how many back and forth things to do.
Well, we didn't see the scene. We got with the kid on the porch and Ronnie and John, and we kind of worked it out, how many answers there would be. John had figured that out, I guess, or whatever. And basically, it took a day or so. And that night, I'm trying to figure it out. I think we stayed overnight up there. And the next day, we went to Atlanta with the editor, Tom Priestley, who knows, editors of the film know every single thing about the film, how long every scene is, all these things. So, and he was great. Tom Priestley was wonderful. He went to the studio in Atlanta called Mastertone, which is pretty strange because my friend was a good Mastertone.
That's weird.
And we just started.
At least it wasn't K. At least it wasn't K Studios. That would have been a bad omen.
Yeah. Hey, gay bands are there.
They're okay. I just talked.
They're okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So we go down there, and we're in the studio. We worked for a long hours on this one scene, doing many takes. I would say we probably did 60 or 80 takes, slightly different as they always come out, you know. And then Tom finally said, "Okay, well, I think we got enough." And they took us to our hotel in Atlanta, and I got a call later in the evening, I guess, and it was somebody from the film, maybe it was Tom, saying they took the rushes of these recordings that we did up to location, played them for John, and he just flipped out. And this is what Tom said to me. He said, "John has flipped out. He wants you to stay down here and do the whole rest of the picture." This is Sunday night now. So that he said this to me. I said, "Well, Tom, that's wonderful, and I'd love to do it. But meanwhile, I haven't shot one frame of film yet, not
really?
One. This is the first scene that they were starting with. They have not shot any film." So I said, "Look, you know, I'd love to do it. We'd love to do it. But I have sessions this week, and I think Steve had some too." I said, "Look, we'll go back to the city, and we'll do our sessions, and we'll take the plane back Friday afternoon. We'll come right here. We'll come right to the hotel, and we'll go right into the studio the next day and work with you on the rest of the film." And that's what happened. So I never really, Tom would tell us, "Well, we have a scene that we need like, 4.5 seconds worth of this is happening, you know, so we play something." And then he said, "Well, we have about a 45-second scene, and we would do some other thing." And Tom was awesome, and we just, everything came out right. And we went back to New York, and I started, I went back to doing my sessions, and Steve did too. And like I said before, I doing a session, and one of the guys said, "Hey, they're playing your record on the radio." I said, "I don't have a record." I mean, the last record I did was New Dimensions, and that was, years before.
Yeah. And just so I remind people, we're talking to Eric Weisberg, and let me ask you a question then, and maybe I always misunderstood. The New Dimensions in Banjo and Bluegrass, that's what you did with Marshall Brickman. That was in the early 60s, right?
Right. I was 62.
I was going to say 62 or 63. So when you you pick up the soundtrack to Deliverance, they've put that album with the dueling banjos. But is that not actually the soundtrack you recorded? You recorded different scenes throughout the movie, so this isn't really the real soundtrack if you go see the movie, right?
No, it is.
It is.
This is what happened. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see if I can pick up where I was now.
Well, you were talking about going back doing sessions and hearing the song on the radio, and then I just occurred to me.
Yeah, right. So this guy says, one of the singers, he says, "You're playing your record." I said, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about." I said, "The last record I did was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever it was." And he said, well, it's you. We know what you sound like, you know. What had happened was, actually, I got an idea because we saw, I was sitting in my attorney's office, and we were laughing and saying how weird this single is going up the charts like crazy. And I came up with, something hit me, and I said, you know, Steve and I could put a bluegrass band together and record 10 tunes, and, you know, in three, we could get it mixed and mastered and everything probably within 2 days or 3 days. And he said, oh, that's a fantastic idea. Let me call Joe Smith at Warner Brothers in California. He gets Joe Smith on the phone, and I'm sitting across the desk, on the opposite side of the desk, my attorney, Richard. So he gets on the phone, he says, hey, Joe, I'm sitting here with Eric, and he says, you know, he could put a thing together for you in a couple of days and 10 tunes, and you'd have an album to put out. And he stops talking, puts his hand over the phone, leans across the desk to me, and said, this is what he says. I'll never forget these four words. He says, the album is out. I said, what do you mean the album is out? What album is out? So he says, well, Joe, what album is out? Well, this, what they did was, what happened is that in the ensuing decade, or two decades, whatever it was, Warner Brothers had bought Elektra.
Oh.
They had bought the company, and that included the library and everything. Right? So Joe Boyd knew that. And he knew that they had this record, New Dimensions, in their catalog.
Oh.
So he just took off the two, you know, a couple of one cut from each side, and put the two sides of the single on there, and put the record. They put the record out. I mean, they didn't even ask us or tell us even or anything. I think it's horrendous, you know, just awful. I mean, it worked out fine for me and all that stuff.
Well, sure.
Can't you have a little respect for somebody's, you know, something? I'm still bugged about it, you can tell. But,
a little
but
bit.
That's what happened. It's bizarre.
I did not know that. I, of course, I mean, how would I know it? But, I mean, that's why we're talking to you now, to find all this good stuff out.
Okay. Well, that's what happened. It's, you know, they put the thing out. First, they put the single was out because when the movie was coming out, they made a bunch of singles and started and sent them around to the disc jockeys so that they could play something read behind when they were talking about, well, there's a movie out now, coming out, or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And they were playing this thing. And one jockey in Minneapolis, I think it was, he started getting phone calls from people. He says, what is this thing that you're playing behind that movie? What is that thing? He says, can we buy it somewhere?
Hmm.
And he didn't know. The jockey didn't know. So he called Warner Brothers, and he told them that. And so they put a single out without telling us. And then they put an album out without telling us or asking us or anything. I mean, it was, you know, like I say, it worked out fine. We had to go through a long court process. I mean, obviously, I know the whole history of the tune. I even have my dad one day in 1955 came home with a 78 that said, what did it say on it? Feud and Banjo.
Feud and, yeah.
Yeah, Arthur Smith and Don Reno. Now, Don Reno is one of my childhood heroes.
Sure.
And I learned how to play from slowing his records down, like I did with Earl, and this and that. And so here's my guys. I'm in, and Don is in there. And Arthur Smith was an incredible guitar player. I mean, you know, he had hit records and everything. And so I know who these guys were. And so I'm in the court now with one of my idols, and on opposite sides, you know, and so I had a talk with Don. I mean, you know, he understood the whole thing, and he was very nice about it, and you know, it got settled before the judge made a decision.
Always a good idea.
Yeah. So, like I said, it worked out for me, and you know, I still got royalties from it and whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we, Eric? Eric, now that we've talked about that, then we're going to come back and talk about the New Dimensions album, and then we're going to talk about Eric the musician. Mm-hmm. But why don't we, in case people haven't heard that version of Dueling Banjos, do you mind if I click off and throw that out, and then we'll come right back?
No, whatever you want to do.
Let's do that. Let's play now. And by the way, okay, just as a reminder, I'm talking to Eric Weisberg, and you've now heard the story from Eric of Dueling Banjos and the soundtrack to Deliverance, and a little bit about New Dimensions and banjo and bluegrass, which we'll talk about. But I think it's a good time to stop, and let's throw out the Dueling Banjos, which was a huge hit. It was a huge hit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gigantic. It just went platinum. I have a platinum record in my
did
garage
really?
Where I keep my motorcycles, and the gold one and all that, which to me is just
it's amazing,
absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, like I say, it's one of the weirdest stories in the history of recorded music.
Well, let's play that tune for the folks out there on Worldwide Bluegrass, and then Eric and I will be back in, if I look over here, it looks like the tune lasts 3 minutes and 16 seconds, so
okay,
hold
call
on.
Back on the cell phone.
No, you just hold on. I'm not going to call you back. Hold on.
I have to listen to it?
No, you won't hear it unless you're on, are you on the radio
okay.
now? Are you dialed in?
Okay.
All right, you're not going to hear it because my speaker, so I turn my speaker.
Okay.
I just went through this 2 weeks ago with that other guy named Steve Martin. I said, I can't do that because we'll get feedback. So you just sit still.
Oh.
You and I will talk, and then the audience will hear the song, okay? All right, hold on. This is it. This is Dueling Banjos. Eric Weisberg, Steve Mandel, you heard the story. And then Eric are just going to be back. We're going to be back here talking and waiting, and you all can listen to Dueling Banjos on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass on Worldwide Bluegrass. Here it comes. And that was it. That was the platinum edition of Dueling Banjos with Eric Weisberg and Steve Mandel. And that's the one that that was everywhere. You could not turn on a radio and not hear that play within an hour. We're back on the air now with Eric Weisberg. So
it's amazing. I mean, when I think about it, I'm not over it. You know, I mean, it's an amazing thing to happen. I mean, it's just weird. The whole story is bizarre. And it happened to me. The series of random events, that just came together at the very end.
And I will tell you what I told you off the air is that Mark Horowitz is in the chat room along with your friend Tom, and they both said hello.
Hey, guys.
And I will also, now for Tom and Mark, I told Eric that they were kind of looking for Bill. Bill's in a truck somewhere picking up. Bill Keith is in a truck somewhere picking up antiques in Martha's Vineyard. So we're not going to get him today, I don't think. Unless he pulls over for his purpose.
Not at this moment.
Not at this moment. All right, that was great. All right, so let me talk again about the. Let's back up a little bit to the New Dimensions in banjo and bluegrass, and I told you, Eric and I have talked. I don't know, 3 or 4 times over the last month and a half. And John Lawless was on the show a couple weeks ago, and he made the statement that he and Bill Evans, who were grew up together, and had New Dimensions in banjo and bluegrass, and they would try to learn different licks off of it, and they're both excellent instructors and great players and know banjos, and they used it as an instructional album. And I told you that on the phone a couple weeks ago, and you said it's interesting that they said that because you and Marshall kind of had a thought that it might be an instructional. Explain that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the New Dimensions is an outgrowth from an album we did before for Elektra. We played a couple of cuts, one of which was Devil's Dream, I think, and people really liked it. And so Jack Holtzman asked me and Marshall to do our own album as a follow-up, in a way. And so we were on tour with the folk of the Terriers that I was with, and Marshall was with us then, going across country and singing in folk clubs and stuff like that. So we had plenty of time to work out stuff in motel rooms and whatnot. And I think the big interest from the previous album was the Devil's Dream thing. And that came about because we both obviously knew Bill Keith, and we had met him at a party, seen him at a party, and he was just kind of starting the melodic thing, and we were totally intrigued by it. And so we figured that maybe we should try Devil's Dream, and do it in harmony and whatever. And so that was, I think, the first thing that we worked on. And that was not easy to do. I mean, we really, in a way, we had an idea of what we were doing and the technique of how to do it and all this stuff. But it took a long time. And then we went from there and did other things with the same kind of thing. But coming from the previous album, we wanted this to be sort of at least partially instructive to people trying to learn, and that's the reason for some of the tunes being very, very long and repetitive, so that people would not have to do what Marshall and I had done, and a lot of other people, I guess, this back, way back, which is listen to a few bars or something, and then take the needle off the record, and then try and work it out, and then put the needle back on, try and find the right groove, and this and that, whatever. We figured if we played some of the things many times over at the beginning, and even starting with them very slow. Pony Express, I think, is one like that. It's just very slow at the beginning. Well, maybe not Pony Express, it's slow, but it is very repetitive, so that you can hear it several times in a row without taking the needle off and stopping and getting interrupted and sort of things like that.
No, it wasn't.
Had this in mind.
Yeah, but it wasn't advertised in that sense. I mean, you didn't try to put it out. You just put it out hoping that people would catch on that that's what we were doing, right?
Yeah, exactly. By the way, the other advantage of the new Dimensions album is Marshall's fantastic liner notes on the back, which, of course, there are no liner notes on a Warner Brothers thing.
No.
You know, it's just a list of the songs, and or the tunes, I should say. And you know, that from that aspect also, Marshall's a great writer, as we know now.
Well, yeah, he used the banjo, and people don't know. Marshall used his experiences on the banjo to launch himself into a screenwriting career with Woody Allen and likes people like that. So.
Well, he was with the Terriers.
Yeah.
And the Terriers, our home club, was the Bitter End in New York City on Bleecker Street. And when we were in New York, the Terriers would always play there. And we had the same manager, Jack Rollins and Charlie Jaffe. And at one point, Woody said to them, his manager, he said, you know, I'd like to try my hand at stand-up comedy. But up until last time, basically been a writer, you know, for the Tonight Show and whatever, all kinds of things. And he said, I'd like to try it. So it worked out that we got booked as a show where at the Bitter End by Fred Weintraub, and Woody was the opening act when we started. And we were, pretty very popular in that location at the time. And Woody started, and he struggled a little bit with it. But by the end, and we were there for, by the way, we were there for 6 months that first show, and Woody was opening act at the beginning of the 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, we were opening act, and Woody was the headliner.
Oh.
That's how fast he caught on, like wildfire. And then I had to go prevent myself from being drafted, so I enlisted in the reserves and had to go away for 6 months. And Clarence Cooper, the other Terrier, had to have open heart surgery for the second or third time while we were gone. So Marshall was looking for something to do, and he was hooking up with Woody because they got along great. They had a similar sense of humor. And Woody was writing Annie Hall, and he asked Marshall to have a sit-in, I think. Something like this. It's pretty close enough. Yeah. And so that's how they collaborated on Annie Hall. And that was a huge hit. And then Marshall got his own movie contracts and stuff like that. Well, Marshall had also been... he was a writer for The Tonight Show. Then The Tonight Show moved to California, and he didn't want to move to California. And so Dick Cavett was getting his own show. So he made, Marshall became the producer of the DeKalb film.
Oh.
In New York. So it's so convoluted, you know what I mean? All these things. But I find, still talking about it, it's so interesting how these things morph from one thing to another without you actually realizing what's happening.
Hey, Eric, tell me about the album cover for New Dimensions, because you mentioned that when we were off the air. Then I want to ask you some questions about your training in music and your other career, so to speak.
Oh, okay. The album cover on New Dimensions is Marshall and me standing under a giant tree in Central Park, just off 59th Street. And in the foreground, we're playing our banjos and looking at a little kid who's about 6 years old, something, maybe like something like that. And the little kid is, in the picture, is Judy Collins' son, Clark. And who is unfortunately committed suicide, and he's no longer with us. But he's a little cute, literally a cute little kid. He was a great kid,
wow.
A great guy, and he's leaning on one of my little tiny 2 foot long piccolo banjos. And so that's the cover.
In
Central Park. Playing the banjo under the trees.
Wow. One more question. People, when I announced that you were going to be on the show, of course, everybody was very excited that Eric Weisberg, and they want to know, even though they're aware of Marshall Brickman's career, that they want to know if he still plays the banjo.
He doesn't. He can't. There's something wrong with his... Let me see. I'm trying to figure out which... Bill Keith had trouble with his left hand. Yeah. So Marshall has something wrong with his right hand, I think, that he cannot bend his... he cannot get his hand out of a curl, the fingers. So he can't really play anymore, which is such a drag, because he loves to play. He loved to play.
Yeah.
And he's a great player. I mean, there's no question about it. He's a terrific player.
And I can tell you this, Eric, I can tell you this, too. Bill Keith is listening, by the way. I just got word a few minutes ago that he is listening. He can't get into the chat room, but if you wanted to say hello to your longtime friend, Bill Keith, who passed you the Dueling Banjos gig, you can do that.
Hey, Bill, take it easy on the wheel in that truck, man. No twisting, you know, going back and forth, like, you know. Okay.
Hey, listen. Good. All right, good. I want to tell people... What you've expressed to me in the last, I don't know, month and a half we've been chatting about doing this. Eric Weisberg, of course, is a famous and influential banjo player in bluegrass world. But what is your musical training? And then you mentioned sessions a little bit earlier, and your session work is just prolific. But let's talk about Eric Weisberg's musical training and your influences a little bit, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Well, my influences are, number one, number one for many reasons, and I think he's the most important banjo player in history, is Pete Seeger, who I met in camp, going to camp. My parents sent me away to a sleepaway camp not far from Woodstock here in Phoenicia when I was 4 years old, 1944, and for 2 months. And I went there until I was 13. And Pete used to come.
Did you get to come back, or did you just come back, or you just stayed from your 40 or 13? Did you? You came back every year, right?
I came back during the winters.
Okay, good.
No, I came back during the winters, and I went to Little Red Schoolhouse for school in the winters on Bleecker Street, just up the street from Bitter End.
Right.
And Pete used to come there in the winters and do the same. Pete would come to the camp and the school and get it and sing for the kids and get us to sing. Even more importantly, he would get us to sing. That was the biggest thing. So Pete is a huge influence on my life. And I started to play the banjo. When I was going to Little Red in music class, I think the music teacher, for some reason or other, I can't remember this, but she handed me a banjo and tuned it up, and I started do whatever. And then just a couple of years later, when I think I was 8 years old or so, I was on the radio, Oscar Brand's radio show, with a class, the music class from Little Red Schoolhouse, and Woody Guthrie was also on the same show, promoting his brand new three records set of 78s that he had just come out. And so I was on the radio with Woody Guthrie here. We didn't play together when I was like, 8 years old. And let's see, then the next progress would be...
I think I've seen this episode on Little House on the Prairie, by the way, but go ahead.
And then a little bit later, Pete's dad suggested, why don't you write a banjo instruction book? There aren't any. And so Pete had, he thought it was a great idea, but he had never really taught anybody how to play the banjo. So he put together a class, I'm going to say 8 people, something like that. We met at Pete's sub-basement apartment on McDougal Street. And I was one of those people invited to be in that class, along with my oldest friend on the planet, Mickey Vandal. We're still playing together after 70 years almost. And so we were in this class with adults and various people, and Pete would give us one technique for the week to go home and practice. And then we would go back the next Saturday, and he would check us out, and Pete has told me many times, maybe I shouldn't talk about this, but it's so bizarre. He said, and it is in print somewhere, he said, Eric, I was 1 week ahead of you. He said, I would give you the class, a new technique, and you guys would go home for a week, and when you came back the next week, you could play it better than I could play it.
Wow.
It was one of those fortuitous, amazing things that I got hooked up with Pete in two places, and for more than one reason, being taught. Of course, there was no bluegrass then. We certainly didn't have it. I'm going to say this was, let's say, from the 60s, so this would be like 1940-45, something like that, somewhere in there. And I'm not sure when Bill Monroe started really formulating bluegrass, but it wasn't much before that. If it was before that,
Eric,
certainly didn't have it up in the north.
Eric, let me ask you this: so do I understand then that the book that Pete wrote, which most people are familiar with, or certainly can be, it's accessible and you can research. Are you saying that he was writing that instructional book for the banjo at the time he was given this class you're talking about?
Yeah, really? That was what he would do. He would write a chapter, give us the technique. And we would go home and practice it and come back the next week and play it for him, and then he would give us another technique, and we would go practice it for a week. And, I guess it was maybe 10 weeks or something like that. It wasn't just, I would say 12 people maybe in the class, something like that. Huh. Not a big class.
So he,
of all ages.
Yeah, so he selected you. How did he, now I understood the camp thing, but how did he select you to be part of this project that would result in the book that he wrote?
Well, I was playing, but I think so anyway, because of the school, Little West Schoolhouse.
Okay.
He knew that I picked it up and was noodling on it. So he, I'm not really sure what his thought process then was, but I'm so glad that he did pick me. And I was saying before, I think Pete is the most important a banjo player in history because he brought the banjo out into the open. I mean, when he was traveling around with Woody, not all that many, got to see him and hear him and all that, but when he came back to the city, and by the way, when I was even younger than that, when I was like 6, to make money, a little bit of extra money right after the war, Pete had in his same apartment on McDougal Street on Saturday mornings a little what he called a wingding. Wingding is a hootenanny during the daytime, by the way, that's according to Pete. He had a little wingding in his house for kids only, little kids.
Wingding.
Where he would sing for us and get us to sing like he always do it. And
still
every,
do it.
Every once in a while, when there was his friend in town, friend, and he had a lot of friends. He would ask them if they would come and sing, and this and that. So, when I was 6 years old, I would be sitting at the feet of who are his friends, his guests, Woody Guthrie, and I was sitting at the feet of these people, listening to them. Woody, Wet Belly, Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry.
Jeez.
Amazing things. And, of course, it's got into my blood. I can't think of Woody's sidekick now, who about 15 years later, after seeing him playing for us, and I'll think of it in a second, but I played on an album, the Cisco Houston.
That's it.
he was doing an album for, I think, Elektra, maybe Folkways, and they selected me to accompany him on his album just a few years later, not even 2 decades later. I'm a professional player now, and I'm playing with Cisco Houston, whose feet I sat at when I was 6 years old.
Wow, so that's sort of your informal introduction to this type of music, but then you had some rather formal training in music, correct?
Well, that's true, yeah. I left junior high, Elizabeth Irwin High School. I auditioned to get into the High School of Music and Art, and thank goodness they saw something in there. I auditioned on the banjo. Nobody had ever done that before or since, I don't think. Even Barrow, who went there, I don't think he auditioned on the banjo. I could be wrong, but I think he told me that he did not do that. And so somebody saw that I had some musical and manual dexterity and could play. I also played a little piano piece or something, And thank goodness I got in there, because I have no idea what I'd be doing now if I didn't get in there. I would have gone to the local high school where I grew up, on the Lower East Side, Stewart Park High School, which was one of the worst in the city. But thank goodness I got in there and I started. A music student had to take an orchestral instrument. If you were a music student, you had to take an orchestral instrument or voice, not piano.
Hmm.
And so I was looking at the choices, and I saw the bass, and I said, well, I never tried the bass. So let me see what the bass is like. So that's where I started studying the bass, and I got pretty good at it, and I started taking private lessons, and then after a year at Wisconsin, rooming with Brickman and another New York banjo player in an apartment off campus, I decided, at that time, this was 1950, this would have been the spring of 58, I said, there's no way on the planet that you can make a living playing the banjo unless your name is Seeger or Scruggs. And so I said, okay, I'm going to leave Wisconsin. I'm going to go back to New York, go to Juilliard, and pick up study again with my same teacher. And that's what I did.
Uh-huh.
And then I got sidetracked. I got asked to join the Tarriers because Eric Darling had gotten picked to, and he was in the Tarriers. He got picked to replace Pete in the Weavers. Pete was going on his own. And the Weavers, the Tarriers were in the middle of a gig at the Village Gate, and they called me somehow or other, and luckily I was home to receive this call. Would you be interested in sitting in on the bass? Oh, I know, it's Leon Bibb. Rick, he was also on the bill with them, and he said, I played bass with Leon. He said, why don't you call Eric and have him come sit in with you on the bass? He probably knows all the tunes. And so just so you look like a trio and not a duet, the rest of the gig. And by the end of the gig, they asked me to join the group. So I actually left Juilliard and I joined the Tarriers and started touring. And I became a part of a really good folk group and had a fantastic time. And I was doing sessions all at the same time. When I was in the city, I would do sessions, and a lot of them on the bass, but a lot of them not on the bass. I mean, I already played the mandolin, the banjo, and the guitar, and some fiddle, and this and that. I hadn't done the pedal steel yet. Maybe I tried the dobro, I'm not sure. But I had this dexterity for this kind of stuff, and really, it's a lot of it. The pedal steel, that's the hardest thing. Don't ever try
the pedal.
No, you got to be nuts.
Is that because
you got to be a little bit nuts?
Is that because
I think every pedal steel player would say the same thing.
Is that because of the work with the knees and the levers underneath it, or?
Yes, all that.
Yeah.
The first thing that's the large thing is just setting the thing up. You take it out of the case, and you have about 15 different parts you have to screw into each other, and turn it over, and all that. A lot more strings than usual, and they change pitch by pressing on levers, and it's really nuts. But I love playing it, and I did a lot of sessions. I think the first session I got pretty good at it, watching Bill Keith. When we were doing, he's the one who got me into it. We were doing the album with Rooney. I can't think of the name of it now. And he was playing the Blue Velvet Band album, Sweet Moments with the Blue Velvet Band. Get this album if you don't have it. It's an incredible album. And I was watching him play steel, and I said, you got to show me some of that. And he said, so I told him the way to get one. Showed me a couple of things. I set it up in my living room in Brooklyn and put on the country music station and just tried to play along with whatever was on the radio. And I think the first session I ever did on a steel was, believe it or not, Country Roads, John Denver.
Really?
You can hear it a little bit, yeah. A little bit in the background.
When you mentioned, we're talking to Eric Weisberg here, if people are just tuning in, you're talking about session work, and you did session work beyond, and actually you performed out of beyond the folk bluegrass area. You've performed with some other genres of music, right?
Well, yes. One of my favorite things of all time, living in the same building that I did was a guy named Earl Robinson, who was a wonderful composer and who I knew of all through the folk years anyway. And every once in a while he would call me up. I think he was three flights above me in this high rise in Brooklyn where I was living with my parents. And he'd say, Eric, could you come up and look at this and see if this is playable on the banjo? And I would go upstairs and he would show me a few bars or something and I would try to work it out. And I said, well, this is good, but this little, these three notes together, that's very awkward. And so he would modify it or not. And I wasn't really sure what it was all about. He was writing a banjo concerto for Pete to play. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I get a call, I would say months later, after going through this, maybe a couple of years, I'm not really sure. I get a call from Pete, and he says, Eric, you got to help me out. I'm in big, big trouble. I said, Pete, what's the matter, man? What happened? He said, well, Earl's writing this banjo concerto for me to play. I said, yeah, I know about it. He said, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget this. He said to me, meet me, I'll be in my car on Park Avenue, just where the overpass is, the 42nd Street, there's a train station. I'll be sitting under there. And so I met him there. And I get in his car, and he had said to me on the phone, Earl is writing this banjo concerto. He says, if I practice this for a million years, I wouldn't be able to play it. He'll verify this. If I practice this for a million years, I would not be able to play it. He said, you're the only person on the planet who can play it. And I would say probably at that time, there's a good chance that that's true. Anyway, so he hands me a sheaf of handwritten scribbles by Earl, the original score and banjo part. And some mini tapes of the parts, And he says, listen to these, this and that. And I said, well, I'll try it, I don't know, man. And I get out of the car, and the last thing, he opens the window on my outside. He says, by the way, the concert's in 3 weeks.
No pressure, but the concert's in 3 weeks.
Yeah. And I'm holding this thing. It's, it's about half the size of the Manhattan phone book, papers. And I go, oh, geez. And this is even better. A year or so before that, I was riding my motorcycle from Brooklyn into the city, getting on the Brooklyn Bridge, and something happened. I had a bad tire or something like that. I slipped and I fell down on the on-ramp and picked the bike up and kept, you know, continuing on my errands in the city. And by the end of the day, my left wrist was not feeling good. So I went to a place on 3rd Avenue, downtown 3rd Avenue, that did walk-in x-rays. And I passed it a million times. I said, I'm going there. I'm gonna, the guy takes an x-ray and a couple of x-rays, three or four of them. I still have these. And he's looking at it. He said, I don't see a break here. There's no break. He said, so I'll put a gauze bandage on some tape or whatever.
Those are hard words for a banjo player to hear, by the way. There's no break.
Yeah, that was good to hear though. But by the end of the day, it was hurting, and I had these x-rays taken, and then he said, there's no break. But I go home and I call my family doctor, who was my friend Mickey's father and my dad's best friend for life. They grew up as little kids in the slums of the Upper East Side, 1910, selling newspapers, running on the street barefoot, and became lifelong friends, and our families were friends. Okay, so I call up Jules and I tell him this. He said, all right, I'm going to come down and look at it. And he put me in a splint. Right? Put me in a splint with my wrist, my hand bent backwards to put pressure on this thing here. No, he just put me in a regular splint. That's what it was, splint. And it started to feel better. After about 3 weeks, I took it off, and it was sort of okay. So that's when I got the call about Pete a little later.
Mm.
And it was hurting too long. And I found somebody else, a different doctor, and he found that it was broken. The banana-shaped bone behind my thumb was broken. And he put me in a cast from my elbow to my fingertips. I said, you have to leave my fingers free so I can make a living and pay you. But my thumb was completely immobilized, sticking out to the left. Okay, that's when I get the call from Pete. I'm in this cast. I'm up in now, and I was subbing for Bobby Owen in Montreal in the middle of the winter in February. It was like 40 below zero, not exaggerating, trying to practice and learn this thing. And, time came. I had to go to Boston.
You practicing with a cast on?
With the cast on. And I had to have my mom open up the sleeve of my tuxedo. The concert was Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Symphony. Okay, we're in Boston, in the concert hall. So now I'm trying to hide my left arm from Arthur Fiedler so he doesn't see this. You know, we go and rehearse. And by the way, I learned this. Plus, I had to write my own cadenza. I mean, Earl didn't write a cadenza for it. You know, usually a solo thing at the end of the first movement. And the third verse, the third movement, had vocals in it. Pete said, I'll come and I'll sing the vocals. And Earl had written the thing in a key for Pete, so I would never have been able to sing it. But Pete came, and he sang it. And it went off without a hitch. I don't think I made any mistakes. I had to write a 4 or 5 minute cadenza or whatever it was. And it came off.
I just want to get this straight, Eric. You played this in a cast.
I played with my four fingers out, free, my thumb totally immobilized in a plastic cast and bent back, and my wrist bent backwards.
This I can't even. I cannot envision this. I can't envision.
I'm doing this position with my hand now, and I say, how could I possibly have done that? But I have photographs. You can see me in the photograph.
Will you send me a photograph, please? Will you send me a photograph?
I'll try.
Scan it and send it to my email. You know how to reach me. I want to see this.
Okay. All right. I'll try and do that. Yeah.
Hey, listen. I'm looking at the back of the Deliverance soundtrack, and you mentioned some of the songs were longer, and they might have had the slower parts or the repetitive parts. And as I look at the back of this, the longer tunes, I see Reuben's Train, Fire on the Mountain. Is one of those that I could play that would kind of fit into that realm of what you're talking about?
I think Old Joe Clark.
Old Joe Clark
is one.
Okay.
I think so.
All right. Well, let's try that.
And let's see. I wish I had it in front of me. Why don't we read them off?
Well, all right. After dueling banjos on side one, there's Little Maggie. That's not very long. Chuck and the Corn. Yeah. Chuck and the Corn, maybe.
No. Marshall played that.
Okay. Pony Express. Old Joe Clark. Eight More Miles to Louisville.
I think it's Old Joe Clark. Yeah. Go ahead.
8 More Miles to Louisville. Farewell Blues. That's 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Earl's Breakdown is 1:52. End of a Dream. Buffalo Gals is 2:18. Reuben's Train is 2:58. Riding the Waves, Fire on the Mountain.
Buffalo Gals. Might be Buffalo Gals. That's thoughts or slow.
Well, let's just see. You know, all we can do is pick another one. But let's see if Buffalo Gals fits in that description. Okay.
Okay.
We'll give it a shot. All right, Eric Weisberg. We're gonna take a break here, and Eric will be with me, and you all will be listening to Buffalo Gals from the ultimately from the New Dimensions in Banjo and Bluegrass, but re-released through Warner Brothers, as you've heard Eric describe it. Buffalo Gals, and this might be in that vein that he was discussing, that they thought would be more instructional, and that it would kind of be repetitive or slower or whatever. Keeping in mind that he knew, as he learned, that you listen to vinyl and pick it up and move it back and forth. Not advertised that way, which I think is fascinating, but not advertised, but New Dimensions in Banjo and Bluegrass had a thought from Eric and Marshall to make it easier to learn tunes, let's put it that way. Fair statement? All right, hold on. We're going to listen to Buffalo Gals. Hold on. All right, Eric Weisberg, we just played Buffalo Gals, and I think you were exactly right. That one started out slowly and was repetitive, and unbeknownst to everybody else who picked that album up, there was thought by Eric and Marshall Brickman to make it more accessible to learning banjo tunes.
Right.
It wasn't on the label that way.
There's another one on there, too. There might be another one on there.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. But yeah, that was we were talking about a month or so ago, and you mentioned that. And off of the air, I mentioned to Eric that John Lawless had no idea. They just thought he and Bill Evans were trying to learn
something about it, but we didn't.
Well, you could put it on the label, maybe that might have helped.
So I've always wondered since Steve told me that at his party.
Now they didn't hear
all those many times that he was on the Letterman show with all those banjo players. Why I was never invited.
you're talking about stuff they didn't hear. We were off the air, and you were talking about Steve Martin knows about your New Dimensions and Banjo and Bluegrass album. That you were at a Kennedy Center function, and he came to you and mentioned to you that he had learned from that album. And I assume, did you tell him that it was meant to be instructional?
No.
You can't keep these things secret forever, and people are going to figure them out. Oh, boy. This is great. This has been, I don't want to keep you all day because I know you probably got motorcycles to ride and cars to polish and banjos to play. But this is, and by the way, just I'm kidding with Eric because he's always doing car shows and he rides a motorcycle a lot. And, of course, you still play banjo all the time.
Yeah, I'm still playing the New York people can go to this a website here and find out what we're doing. Bill Keefe is involved in this also. Tony Trischka, Bela, a whole bunch of guys. Go to this website, nybanjo.org.
Okay.
nybanjo.org.
Okay. Great. Well, Eric, listen, I am thrilled to get a chance to speak to Eric Weisberg, and thanks so much for coming in. You wanted to stay about an hour. We're right about there, so we have a lot more to cover. Anytime you want to come back in, and we can pick it up and go from there if you want.
Okay.
The door is always open. Once you make a phone call, you can call anytime you want to. Just got to let me know ahead of time.
All right, man.
All right, Eric Weisberg. Yeah. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
My pleasure.
Yeah, see you, bye.
Good. Okay.
That was good. I've talked to Eric maybe four or five times since we started playing in this, and I always learn more every time we talk to him. So I appreciate Eric Weisberg so much for calling in and making time. He's a busy man, and what a talented guy. And the stories just go and go and go, and they can reconnect and recircle around kind of like a Charles Dickens novel at some point when you talk to Eric long enough. And we're going to play some more music, and maybe we'll get Eric back in the future. I think we could do that. Thanks so much, everybody in the chat room. We're still here. I'll be here for about another hour and a half.